Welcome to the First Things Podcast, Episode 3. Our topics this week are the murder of a country priest by Islamic State militants in France, the slightly confusing religious affiliations of the two new vice presidential nominees, and a session of Ask the Theologian featuring Francesca Murphy. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. I'm joined by Literary Editor Matthew Schmitz. Matthew, how are things?
They're going very well.
We're without our boss this week. Rusty Reno is off scaling a mountain somewhere in Nevada or California. Mark Bauerlein, senior editor, is zooming around the Acela Corridor. In their stead, we're joined by Francesca Murphy, who is senior fellow at First Things and professor of systematic theology at the University of Notre Dame. Francesca, good to have you.
Great to be here.
So let's get into it. On Tuesday this week, two young men with knives, claiming allegiance to the Islamic State, entered a church outside of Rouen in Normandy, France, during morning mass. They took hostages, including two nuns, and delivered a sermon in Arabic. They forced the priest to kneel before the altar and then slit his throat. The priest was Jacques Hamel, 85 years old. Pope Francis had some thoughts on the occasion. He condemned this act of absurd violence and all forms of hatred. He especially deplored the fact that the killing had occurred in a church, a sacred place in which the love of God is announced. Matthew, Francesca, co-sign those sentiments or not?
I think the Pope has to think about the safety of Catholics in Europe and in the Middle East, and he can't say anything that could be remotely inflammatory or undermine the safety of Christians in the Middle East. So he can't say something which a conservative journalist might say. He has to simply condemn. And the other thing which I noticed, the bishops in France, in Switzerland, I think they're really trying to lower the temperature as much as they can, because there is a serious danger now of retaliation. There could be blood in the streets, and I think the bishops really want to tamp that down, and for very good reason.
Yeah, there's an interesting rhetoric of religious conflict that's emerged in some quarters in the aftermath of this attack. It was Sarkozy or one of these ex-French officials who said that there's a lot being done right now to foster a war between religions.
That's right.
And that seems like a very new thing.
Yes.
In to have politicians speaking openly about strife in specifically religious terms. I mean, that's something that politicians in the West have tended to avoid as much as possible, I think. But that's sort of coming out now, but not from the Vatican.
Well, on his way to World Youth Day in Krakow on Wednesday, Pope Francis offered further thoughts on this. He said that what we're seeing is not a religious war. It is a more normal war. It's a war for money, for the domination of people, for oil. And it's not a religious war. Now, Francesca says that Pope Francis has to be careful in his statements, not pose as a crusader. I'm sensitive to that, but it's also worth asking what is in fact the case. So first of all, I'm not sure what to make of, I'd like to offer my intellectual submission to all papal hot takes, but if that's not the duty of a Catholic, I think it's worth asking whether or not Francis is right when he says that, we need to condemn violence of all forms. I mean, is it really just violence simply? That's the problem. Or when he says that this is not a war that involves religion, is that the case? We know that ISIS wants to target the Vatican. Is there a great deal of oil in the Vatican? There are certainly religious motives at play. And, right now, a lot of European elites are trying to avoid inflammatory rhetoric. They're trying to tamp things down. They're actually suppressing statistics about attacks. They are encouraging people not to share photos or news on social media. There may be prudence in that, but if it becomes a way of ignoring reality, it's very dangerous in itself.
Yeah, I believe one of the nuns who
was taken hostage in this incident in Rouen said that the attackers said to them something like, "You Christians, you kill us." And that was the explicit motive for their retaliation.
Now, this is a lie, but they believe it. So,
right.
And they have, you know, they have this whole ideology that we are the crusaders, this, right. They're that. Now, however much the Bush administration scrupulously insisted that we were not crusading, or in the invasion of Libya, you know, be, you know, carefully secular in invading Libya, it's still perceived as a crusade.
Right. You know, so we published a brief but very potent essay on our website Tuesday evening by Jean Duchesne, who is a longtime advisor to successive archbishops of Paris. And he was very, one of the points that he wanted to make very clearly was that the target of this revenge was not, you know, the West in its, you know, sort of secular economic form, however oppressive that may be or be perceived to be outside the West. The target of this revenge was the root of the West, I'm quoting him now, the West's living source, even when it is unremembered, namely Christianity, in the time and place where, tacitly but invincibly, it becomes most explicitly and intensely real, the celebration of the Mass. And I thought it was interesting to contrast that very strong statement of the sort of particularity, the religious particularity of this target, contrast that with Francis's description of the site of this attack. He said, oh, what did he say? He deplored the fact that this violence had taken place in a church, a sacred place in which the love of God is announced. I mean, that could be... that could be lots of religious sites. That could be a Catholic church. That could be a Protestant church. That could be a mosque. That could be anywhere.
I don't share Francis's instincts on this. I also don't want to, you know, spend too much time picking apart what I'm sure is a statement offered very quickly. I did love the statement offered by Cardinal Seurat, who said, you know, how much longer must the situation continue before the leaders of the West understand what's going on? How many more decapitations, you know, and Seurat, who speaks forcefully, some people say he speaks too forcefully, is speaking more to our moment.
Well, my piece that I, the piece by Father Duchesne, which I, was it, is he a priest, Jean Duchesne?
I don't think so.
The piece that I translated by Jean Duchesne ended with the words, we will respond to hatred with love.
Right.
And the other piece I translated by Remy Bragg ended with almost exactly the same expression, mm-hmm. that Christians respond to hatred with love.
Yeah, and Duchesne explicitly said, we're going to keep our doors, we're going to keep the doors of our churches open.
Yes, and we're going to love the people who regard us as enemies.
Right.
And so there's no, both of those pieces are dealing with the same concern I mentioned, that we must not respond to violence with violence.
Right. Right. Well, and so this brings us to, I think, a substantive political and policy aspect of this whole situation, which is, you know, related to the issue of terrorism is the issue of immigration. Related to the issue of the Christian roots of the West is the identity of Europe today and its demographic makeup.
Europeans today seem to think that they do have Christian roots, but these Christian roots mean only one thing. They must deny Christianity. They cannot discriminate against anyone who's non-Christian. They have to tolerate all comers, regard them with perfect equality, and they cannot explicitly, publicly acknowledge, at least, you know, in non-euphemistic terms, the Christian identity of Europe. That's how European leaders think. I thought it was interesting that an African leader, Cardinal Seurat, seems to think differently. Maybe he's able to see something about Europe that Europe's leaders aren't able to see today.
Francesca, you are European. Or British. Does that count as European?
Yes.
Okay.
But weren't you?
The EU is not Europe.
You were a Brexit supporter, Francesca.
I know, but the EU is not Europe. Europe is much deeper, richer, and more profound than the EU. The EU is simply a bureaucratic structure, which all Europeans should leave. Get out as quickly as you can.
All right. On that note, we'll wrap up this segment. Thanks, guys. Thank you.
both of the 2016 vice presidential nominees are Catholic or Catholic-ish. Hillary Clinton has called upon Tim Kaine, a Catholic of the personally opposed but variety. Donald Trump has tapped Mike Pence, who at some points in his career has called himself an evangelical Catholic. We'll get to Kaine in a moment. I want to dwell first on Pence. So Pence as evangelical Catholic, I confess that I don't know what that designation means in this usage. I'm aware that George Weigel wrote a book titled Evangelical Catholicism, in which the phrase denotes an observant, ardent, mission-oriented, JP2-style Catholicism. Does that describe Pence? Pence is a guy who was raised Catholic, was born again in some sense in 1978, still practiced Catholicism for some years after that, began attending an evangelical megachurch in 1995, and has never looked back, as far as I can tell. There's an argument out there on the internet, which maybe is too hostile, maybe is quite fair, that evangelical Catholicism in this usage is a political fiction. It's just something that politicians say when they want to look like they're batting for both teams, but probably are batting for one or for neither. Am I being unfair? Matthew Schmitz, you were raised evangelical and are now a Catholic. Do you consider yourself an evangelical Catholic or a regular Catholic? What insights can you offer?
I consider myself a Catholic and an evangelical, both. I don't count as an evangelical because by evangelical lights, because evangelicalism remains very anti-Catholic. You can't serve on the faculty of Wheaton if you become a Catholic, though you can profess almost anything else and probably still wiggle by. But I'm sympathetic to Mike Pence's description of himself this way. He's turned his back on the Mass, which is a terrible thing, though many have done it. But I suspect that what he means by the phrase is just, I'm an evangelical, but I have no polemic. I have no big argument to prosecute against my Catholic upbringing. Probably he wants to signal a certain appreciation, even if it is now from a distance.
I'm really unsympathetic. I think it means that he's evangelical unlike Catholics. He's an evangelical Catholic. Unlike the Catholics, who are completely without evangelical roots.
Yeah, well, I mean,
I'm just unsympathetic.
Right,
He's doing a cultural appropriation thing with his Catholicism and holding on to that. But he's evangelical, unlike the Catholics he's left. So he's an evangelical Catholic, unlike the Catholics who were just...
Yeah, I guess the reason I don't take it that way, you know, I was raised in an environment where we were Christians. We were the Christians unlike the Catholics. And I remember riding in the back of a pickup truck once on my grandfather's farm with my cousin, and I was sharing my faith with him and telling him about Jesus Christ, who he certainly did not know because he was a Catholic. I later became a Catholic, but you know, for me, back then there were the Christians and then there were the Catholics. So when you have someone like Mike Pence being willing to even call himself a Catholic when he's become an evangelical instead of strongly reject that, that's definitely a step away from the intense anti-Catholicism that prevails in certain parts of American Protestantism.
Do you think it might even be, in some quarters, a political disadvantage? You know, there are evangelicals for whom that hybrid label is not impressive, but looks kind of treacherous and bizarre.
No, I think Americans are pretty loosey-goosey about these things. Most evangelicals were happy to vote for Mormons who they consider, for Mormon Mitt Romney, who they consider a heretic. I, for one, would be happy to see Mike Lee, the Mormon senator, installed as a Caesar. I'd like to just turn our polity over to him and to a Mormon ruling class because they have preserved WASP virtues without accepting the worst of the left-wing ideology. And so I'd like to just see the Mormons run the country, and I think a lot of Americans feel the same way. Perhaps we'll see that happen in the coming years. But I'd also like to, you know, talk. I have more of a beef with Tim Kaine, I gotta say. I have more of a beef with Tim Kaine than I do with Mike Pence.
Okay, we'll get to Kaine in a moment. Francesca, Does this all seem just bizarrely American to you? Do you have evangelical Catholics in Britain?
No, we don't have evangelical Catholics. We don't even have Catholic evangelicals.
Mm.
So yeah, the religiousness of America is striking to all Europeans.
Yes.
Our politics is completely secular.
We don't do God.
That's correct. That's right. What Tony Blair said, we don't do God.
Right.
Before we wrap up, Pence, I just want to drop one footnote. I have some resistance to the term evangelical Catholic in a political context, but this is a critique that is usually mounted by progressives. It's progressives who usually deny that evangelical Catholicism is really a thing, and they do so because they view the term and the concept as being useful to culture warriors on the right. It affects a religio-political alliance, the evangelicals and Catholics together. That's a phrase that should be familiar to a lot of our readers. It's the title of a politically significant ecumenical document from 1994, co-signed by Chuck Colson and our founder, Richard John Newhouse. The evangelicals and Catholics together may be strong enough to impose a traditional religious agenda on the rest of America. So there was a religion blogger quoted by the Washington Post a few days ago, and he had this to say, quote, "Just because a few Catholics and evangelicals subscribe to the same conservative magazine does not mean that there is such a thing as evangelical Catholicism." I think he's talking about us.
Oh.
Anyway, I like to think that he's talking about us. Let's move on to Cain. There's a Washington Post headline from a few days ago. Now that Cain is Clinton's VP pick, will his faith matter? This is a trick question. As a United States senator, Tim Kaine earned 100% ratings from Planned Parenthood and Neural, though he swears he's personally opposed to abortion. As governor of Virginia, he implemented the death penalty, though he swears it gave him pain. He has supported same-sex marriage and gay adoption with no apparent conflict. He urges the ordination of women as priests in the Catholic Church, which doesn't do that. But he really enjoyed Laudato Si. And the Post quotes a sociologist from Catholic University who describes Cain as a Pope Francis Catholic. So, Tim Cain as Pope Francis Catholic. Discuss.
He should read Laudato Si. He should read the parts where contraception and the transgender ideology are rejected very strongly and understand the way that connects to Pope Francis's larger economic and environmental views. Just a suggestion.
He can't have ever read it. The whole theology of nature, the whole theology of creation is completely...
It's a little long, I guess. It's pretty long, but it's very good.
We could direct him to some appropriate segments.
Yeah, so who was it that said ignore everything that comes before the but? You know, personally opposed, but publicly supportive.
But why is he personally opposed? Well, I mean, if it's not a baby, why is he personally opposed at all? What's the point of being personally opposed? What's he personally opposed to?
I think that the personally opposed language is this kind of wonderful verbal construction designed for extracting, you know, maximum self-congratulation and moral smugness from a position in which you're unwilling to actually take a stand. So he gets to say, I'm a man of the left. I'm against the death penalty. I'm a good Catholic. I follow John Paul II, but I'm going to execute people. You know, that doesn't really hold water.
Does he support the death penalty?
No, he's personally opposed to the death penalty.
So how can he be a Pope Francis Catholic? Francis is all about the organic connection between personal conviction and the world at large, politics, spirituality, all organically connected. That's what Francis is about.
So I think here's my argument for why maybe Cain has a point. Someone also said that he was a Dorothy Day Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of people joked about this and said, oh, does that mean he's he seeks the abolition of the state, is opposed to the New Deal, thinks that the U.S. entry into World War II was a crime, and rejects contraception. So in defense of Tim Cain, I would say that to say someone is a Pope Francis Catholic means a downplaying of these pelvic issues, you know, abortion, gay marriage, which Pope Francis has done.
He told us to stop obsessing.
Yes, he says don't obsess, though his positions are very clear and Catholic. He doesn't want to talk about it. And then also Pope Francis, I think, has advanced a certain negative tendency, a certain bad tendency in Catholic thought, which is to treat the Catholic teaching as a kind of advanced veganism. So, you know, we have to be pacifists. All wars are bad. Well, contraception is bad. This is bad. That is bad. But of course, we can't really take any of this seriously. So you might admire the person who actually does all that, like the pacifist, like the Dorothy Day type. Oh, I admire Dorothy Day, but it's not, I mean, I admire, but I will never emulate.
So Catholicism as advanced veganism, that's our takeaway.
Veganism and nudism, a kind of, you know, extreme moral and ethical eccentricity.
We're immensely fortunate to be joined today and every day by Francesca Murphy, Professor of Systematic Theology at the University of Notre Dame and currently Senior Fellow at First Things. Francesca keeps us on the true path. She is a theologian of great wisdom and erudition. We refer all our profound and esoteric questions to her, for we know that she is a careful stewardess of Catholic truth. In this spirit of perfect reverence and zeal, we open a session of Ask a Theologian featuring Francesca Murphy. Are you ready, Francesca?
Fire away.
We have a number of questions to put to you, submitted by readers and editors of First Things. Our first question comes from assistant editor Alexi Sargent. It seems that Alexi has been reading some narrative theology lately. He's confused by it, and he wants to know, is God a story?
No, God is not a story. God is above the world story and outside of the world story. He enters the world story and changes it, and he's guiding the world story to its end. But if he was in the story or a character in the story, then the story would be God, and God would not be God. So the question is, who's God? History or God? And God is God, not history and not the story. We don't believe in a story. We believe in God.
So God is not a story, and if Alexi has further questions, he should consult your eponymous book on narrative theology. Our second question comes from Olivier in Manhattan. Olivier asks, do all dogs go to heaven?
I don't know about the bad dogs. I mean, we have to hope. That's the thing. It's a question of hope because we can never preempt what God will do. And we don't know what the stage will look like at the end of the play. We have to hope and pray for all the good dogs, that all will be judged worthy at the end of time. But we can't know.
I think there are some cat owners who subscribe to First Things. What do you have to say to them? Do you have any words of consolation or hope for them, for people who have recently lost their pet cats?
As I mentioned, there will be purgatorial fire for bad dogs. Any Stafford Terrier that decapitated a cat has a long purgatory ahead of him. That's all I can say.
Jorge in Rome wants to know, who am I to judge?
Who are you to judge indeed? I think that Pope Francis's statement has been somewhat overinterpreted, perhaps. He was talking about an individual. And I remember Peter Kreeft saying that when Jesus says, judge not that you be not judged, he's not talking about crimes, he's talking about motivations and the motivations of sinners. So you can always say stealing is wrong, adultery is wrong, any form of extramarital sex is wrong. But you cannot judge people's personal motivations because the only person who sees the heart is God. So all Pope Francis is saying is that only God sees the heart. And isn't that true? I mean, how can we really object to that? That's what Jesus said.
Word.
This question comes from Anonymous at Castel Gandolfo. Anonymous asks, how many popes are there right now?
There's one pope. That Pope Francis is the pope, and the Pope Emeritus is shadowing him, but he isn't the pope anymore.
But why does he wear white?
Why does he wear white? It suits him. I think it's an act of humility, because as a pale kind of person, pale flesh. He doesn't look good in white. So I think that probably he wears white as an act of humility because he looks better in red and darker colors. But maybe he burned all his old clothes when he became Pope, assuming that he would wear white for the rest of his life, and all he's got left is white.
That's so poignant. This next question is from me. Can you point me in the direction of liturgical east?
I really wish that the priest would face east during Mass. It would be a really great reform, and I was really delighted when Cardinal Sarah said that. And I was a bit disappointed when the decision was criticized from the Vatican, to be honest.
I detected a note of hysteria in the reaction to that. I mean, it was really visceral. People rejected it very strongly. A lot of people wrote up things saying, the Pope has slapped down Sarah.
Yes.
Gleefully. Yeah. He's been put in his place.
Right, and his place is what? He's the prefect for the Congregation for Divine Worship. It's precisely his place to opine about liturgical matters.
Right. So what's behind that defensiveness? I mean, I myself don't understand. I don't share it. I think that would be a fine reform. It doesn't strike me as horrible or shocking that this would be done, but why do some people feel that way?
They just think that it's all part of going back to the old Mass where we don't participate.
Right. So
and the priest is going to have his back to us.
It's a proxy battle about the direction of the church. Is
yes.
it one of retrenchment?
Yes.
Or one of further opening?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Final question submitted by literary editor Matthew Schmitz. Have you seen any good movies lately?
I did not submit that question. That is a lie.
Last night I saw Captain Fantastic.
Was it fantastic?
It was really grim. It was so grim. See, I love movies about eccentric families, having come from one. And
point of order, what does this have to do with theology? Come on.
It's it starts off and it's about an eccentric family, and the wife has died, and so they have to go back into the normal world because in the normal world, the grandparents, who are sort of played as these Christian Dracula kind of couple, they want to rescue the wife's body from Christian burial, because the wife said in her will that she wanted to be cremated and then have her ashes flushed down the toilet. And so they leave their hideout in the forest and come into the straight normal world, and they rescue the wife's body and they actually disinter it from this grave, which has got certain written over the gravestone.
So
they want
to cremate it.
Yeah, they want to cremate it. Yeah, the whole thing is... But it says on the tombstone, it says, for the repose of the eternal soul of Leslie. So it is eternal soul versus flush down the toilet. And that's what this movie is about. Rescuing from Christian burial, from the eternal soul thesis, and flushing the ashes down the toilet is the high point of the movie.
Okay.
I mean, that is your Christian veganism. What a movie, my goodness.
Yeah, I think
if you wanted to do any reparation after the murder of Father Hamel, I would suggest going to see this movie.
That's a great Christian recuperation of what sounds like a wretched hippie film, and that is why we ask a theologian whether she's seen any good movies lately.
The bishops of France asked us to fast in reparation on Sunday.
Good. That's a good thing to dedicate ourselves to.
Absolutely. Rather than a film recommendation, then, let's leave our listeners with a penitential recommendation. That's all for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleague, Matthew Schmitz. Thanks also to Francesca Murphy for her wit and wisdom. And thank you, listeners. We'll do it again next week.